It's time to say words which are my I'm doing that on purpose, you'll understand why later. Words which are my absolute favourite to utter in a working week, and those words are, hello, Rebecca Davis.
Hello, John. I got exceptionally anxious during that dead air. My palms started to sweat uncontrollably.
We'll get to why in a bit, but The metropolitan governments are now all decided. There were big surprises when the DA took municipalities in Gauteng, and then there was an anticipation that they would take eThekwini as well. That expectation was dashed. That has been kept by the ANC, which now has it has three: Mangaung, it has Nelson Mandela Bay, and it has eThekwini, and the rest are run by DA people with mayoral chains around their necks for the next week or month or 5 years. Who knows? Is it possible to draw up a list of winners and losers this early on in the process?
Well, to me, the standout winner is the DA. I mean, to end up with, I think you gave them one extra chain there because ANC also has Buffalo City. But to end up with four mayoral chains out of eight main metros, especially considering that their electoral results was substantially weaker than 2016, I think that is a tremendous outcome for the DA that they should be thrilled with. And I also think it speaks to the hard-nosed nature, frankly, that they went about coalition negotiations. And probably a lot of credit is due to Helen Ziller, someone I don't often give credit to, but it is clear that, you know, that kind of institutional experience probably really took the DA a long way. I think that Action SA, given their really quite impressive debut electoral showing, were unlucky not to come out of this with the Joburg mayoral chain. I mean, there was a fair expectation that having won the third most votes in that metro, the DA might be persuaded to trade them for Tshwane. But clearly the DA was absolutely intransigent in its insistence that they would not put up with another Herman Mashaba mayoral seat, since they claimed the last time he became a de facto EFF mayor. And so the result is, of course, that the Action SA will have to wait for its major spoil. I must say, John, looking now that the dust has settled and everything, I'm feeling relieved and lucky to be a resident of Cape Town, because it is one of only two metros, the other being Buffalo City, where you can be pretty certain about who is going to govern your metro for the next 5 years. Those are the only two metros where there is a healthy political majority enjoyed by one party or the other. But even in the, you know, the less high-profile metro negotiations over the past weeks, Mangaung, for instance, the ANC has taken power with a single seat. If there is one by-election loss in the Free State capital over the next 5 years, they will be scrambling for a coalition partner. You know, in Nelson Mandela Bay as well, the ANC's grip on power via coalition is so tenuous that they still need one opposition vote to pass the budget. Looking at this, I mean, it is very clear that the ANC has done disastrously, even worse than we expected when the votes were actually counted. The fact that they came within a hair's breath of losing eThekwini really can't, I mean, that is just a seismic result, and that's something that we can't understand. And, you know, critics have said for some time that if the ANC wasn't serious about reform, it risked kind of designating itself to being a party of rural voters, a party of older voters. And what these results show us is that that is happening. That is very much happening. And then if I could just take a look at the mayors, which I'm quite interested in, John. I mean, personally, I find the most fascinating mayor by quite a mile to be the DA's Tshwane mayor, Randall Williams, for the fascinating fact that he spent 6 years in the French Foreign Legion, which I think must surely be a first for any South African mayor. That aside, though, we as the media, I think, and also the opposition, are going to be looking closely at the mayors of both eThekwini and Mangaung. In eThekwini, of course, it's a continuation of Mxolisi Kaunda, who is best known for having tweeted in support of Zuma during the July unrest and then refusing to back down. And in Mangaung, it's a well-known Ace Magashule supporter who is taking the mayoral seat in that place. Xolisi Sionzane is the ANC mayor there, and he also has been accused of basically covering up Magashule's patronage politics for, you know, years and years as in his position as Metro Speaker. So those are two for whom I think voters might hold legitimate concerns about. The one that I'm pretty excited about is Nelson Mandela Bay's new mayor, Eugene A. Johnson. And partly, she's an ANC mayor, but partly I'm encouraged because her background is in activism rather than politics, which at this stage of the game strikes me as just having to be a political plus. And also because she seems genuinely committed to the idea of collaborative coalition politics, which is something that everyone is going to have to get behind. She would not share plans with the media, for instance, because she said these had to be thoroughly discussed with the coalition partners. And I think that is the way that people are going to have to proceed if there's going to be any political maturity in these unstable situations.
I would agree with you absolutely, Rebecca, that the ANC was the big loser in all of this. And there is no doubt that the DA is a short-term winner. Where I want to hold off placing my bet for a while is how long that is going to remain a clear tick in the winner's column for the DA. Action SA, and particularly the EFF, which has acknowledged as such, is hoping that the DA will not be able to handle the governments of these fractious metropoles that they now are mayors of, and that that will rebound to their debit rather than to their credit. Helen Ziller said to me when I spoke to her a couple of days ago that, don't worry, we'll be able to say the reason we didn't govern as well as we wanted to is because of the opposition ganging up against us. But I'm not sure that it'll be that easy to make that claim if the DA is, through the very nature of these fragile coalitions, not able to be as efficient as they always claim to be in government.
That's a good point, John. And I think a lot is dependent on the cordiality or lack thereof from Action SA and EFF. And in interviews this week, Herman Mashaba has seemed exceptionally bitter about the DA. And as you say, the EFF may be intending to play an actively kind of sabotaging role. But just to note that it is not unthinkable that a hung council lacking a formal coalition could in some measure manage to govern with stability. The Daily Maverick's election analyst Wayne Sussman pointed me to the case of the municipality of Modimolo Mokopong in Limpopo, where the DA and the Freedom Front Plus were in a coalition but required the outside support of the EFF to govern. And despite the fact that this is a part of the country that has some of the most radical and conservative voters seemingly kind of cheek by jowl, the parties were able to govern in relative stability for 5 years. Now, I don't know who the personalities involved were there who managed to set their egos aside clearly in quite an impressive way. But it shows that in politics, nothing is impossible. So we shouldn't expect total doom and gloom just yet, even though we might rightly be cynical.
Fair enough. And Len, let's move on to something. Well, I mean, I don't know if it is further afield, but it's not about South African politics or the South African COVID environment. The lovely story about a high school English teacher who says that social media has, far from making people illiterate, which is often the accusation, has improved writing, particularly the writing of teenage boys.
Yes, I love this. It's a great article in The Atlantic, if anyone wants to find it. I think the headline is something like, "Facebook has transformed my students' writing for the better," in which an American high school teacher makes the argument that, yes, let's acknowledge that, you know, students these days use emojis where they shouldn't and all kinds of ridiculous abbreviations or whatever. So he's not arguing that, you know, the technical stylistic aspects of their writing has improved as a result of social media. But he makes the case quite effectively, I think, that Facebook in particular has allowed teenage boys to be candid about their feelings in a way that would previously have been deemed socially unacceptable. And he says that, in fact, his male students who share very openly on Facebook about things like their feelings or their affection for their friends or their personal vulnerability actually tend to win quite a lot of social approval because they get likes from girls who appreciate this kind of candor. And that seems to have a kind of roll-on effect whereby boys feel free to like those posts too. And although that doesn't translate directly into the mean streets of high school, his suggestion is that he's noticed as a result perhaps that they're used to this confessional mode on social media, his male students have become a lot better about writing from a place of kind of openness and honesty and vulnerability and sharing their feelings in a way that often teenage girls are expected to and allowed to, and previously boys haven't really been, you know, it just isn't expected of boys in the same way. And he suggests that the results have actually been wonderful, like really liberating for both students and the teacher. And he suggests that, you know, as bad a rap as we often give social media, particularly for its influence on teens, actually the emotional openness that's encouraged by these forums provides perhaps a simulation of how a better kind of social environment could work for young men in the real world. I like that a lot, John.
Yeah, I mean, it's not saying that it makes them better writers, more grammatical writers, better spelling, better word choice, but it is working in a very, very important way, because, you know, without being too simplistic, one of the reasons why so many men are so horrible to so many women is to do with that blunted emotionality.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. John, the thing just happened to me. A brain freeze.
You've never had a brain freeze in your life.
I had a thought leading on to that on the tippy top of my tongue, and it completely disappeared, and then I just said, that's exactly right, and froze.
No, you didn't. I actually haven't seen. You told me in your Thursday email to me that Boris Johnson has had a much talked about brain freeze, but I try not to have a look at anything involving Boris Johnson more than once a quarter, and I've already done it for this quarter. So, but I will go and have a look. Tell us about it.
Boris Johnson gave the most, I must admit, John, I have really conflicted feelings about Boris Johnson, because I recognize objectively he is a buffoon and I would hate him to be my own prime minister, but I cannot help but find him desperately amusing at times, often unintentionally, as was the case here. He gave a speech to a business council in the north of England, which was characterized by several bizarre things. He imitated the sound of a car for quite a while. He compared himself to Moses, and he went on a lengthy tangent about Peppa Pig world, and also compared Peppa Pig to a hairdryer drawn by Picasso, which is frightfully good, John. I mean, that is exactly what Peppa Pig looks like. But the worst part of this whole debacle was the moment when he lost his place. He was listing some of the kind of campaign promises, etc., and he started riffling frantically through his notes, and then just fell silent and said over and over again, forgive me. Forgive me for what the BBC reports was an excruciating 21 seconds. 21 seconds, John, as you will be able to tell your listeners, is actually very long in these contexts.
It is. You asked me if I'd ever had a similar kind of brain freeze. And yes, I have had moments where a name that I was reaching for wasn't there, but I've always said, oh, what is that name now? Oh, sorry, I can't remember. It'll come to me later. And I've always been able to keep going. I mean, listeners might go, oh, John, you forget. And they might remember many brain freezes from me. But I don't think, and I've been in broadcasting for nearly 35 years, I don't think I've had one. What happens to me far more often is that I start a sentence or a thought or a sentence to try and express a thought without any clear idea of where I'm going to end up. And then halfway through, I realize I'm making no sense, intellectual or grammatical whatsoever. And I have to stop and say sorry and start again.
I think, John, though, you would agree that you are given a fair bit more leeway as a result of being a broadcaster on a fairly relaxed medium. I mean, it's not, you know, Jawl FM, but it's a talk station, so you're allowed to kind of ramble a bit. I think the most excruciating of these situations must be in situations like a live studio audience. And there have been broadcasters like the UK's Adrian Childs coming forward in sympathy for Boris Johnson with their own examples of where they have simply, every earthly thought has just fled out of their head, leaving them just staring helplessly at the camera. And my question is, what is the best thing to do in that situation? I mean, Boris's approach was very poor, which is just to kind of look at his papers and say, forgive me, forgive me, forgive me. I think probably, John, and you'll weigh in here, the best thing to do is to come clean and simply say, goodness, I've lost my train of thought. But perhaps that's just not acceptable when you're the prime minister of one of the world's largest economies.
Yeah. Goodness me, I've lost my train of thought. Postman Pat, Postman Pat, Postman Pat. Sing that to try and get you back on the right train of thought. Rebecca Davis, thank you very much.